Well, hello. Good afternoon. Bonjour, hi. And welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz, back in the zone. Slancha to you all. The bunker has managed to stay dry, but yet it is quite cold. Yet the show must go on, so a couple of sweaters and a blanket, no problemo. And went out and bashed the antenna a couple of times. We're good to go. And speaking of good to go, on the line, I hope I have Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico and of End Credits and of this show and of all the things that he does. Adam, are you with us?
No, I'm not here.
You're not there? Oh, no. I'm going to have to do a whole hour of speaking to myself about the events of the day. Goodness gracious. Good to hear that you are there indeed. Today we are going to discuss pipeline politics, which are back in a big way, in two significant ways in North America. We'll dig a bit into that and see what the heck's going on there. Also, and a topic that Adam likes to call, quote, loser news, the latest in the Trump saga south of the border, who just will not give it up. He will not pack it in. And we'll talk a bit about that. But before that, we have a whole half hour about a topic, of course, that's, well, it's on all of our minds. It's on the planet's mind. COVID-19, both globally and nationally. But to start off, we're going to talk about the province and some local issues, Adam, and, you know, positive vaccine news last week and early this week is a bit heartening for the globe. There's been, I guess, three different vaccines. I jumped right into global there as opposed to local. I wanted to talk about, because it also happened at the kickoff at the top of the week, the non-disclosure agreement that the so-called provincial table had to sign. That is the group that are consulting with the province as to how they should proceed with all things COVID. Particularly Dr. Davila was commenting on it in the Toronto Star. She didn't seem too, I guess she's not allowed to seem too upset about it. It's like, yeah, we signed a non-disclosure. We can't really say too much. But this came in the wake of the new color-coded system that was released. And I have to say, I was a little bit confused with the system. In particular, the change up this way from yellow to orange, and looking at the first chart that I saw, I couldn't really see any significant differences other than the R number, the amount of cases per 100,000 that were going on. So it should be a lot easier when you have a color-coded system, but it's really difficult to kind of parse out from it what you are and aren't supposed to be doing. And man, if I hear anything else about a gym, if every top story I hear is, I guess, you know, I need to maybe travel the mainstream media a bit less when watching the news. But my goodness, there's so many stories about, oh, the gym's going to close. And it might be the least of our worries, at least, as to whether the gym's open or closed.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I put a lot in there. Sorry, I just I let her go. I thought I was going to talk to myself. No, I'm just kidding. But
no, that's a lot to unpack. I mean, the color-coded system thing, I think this is what's the problem with a lot of color-coded systems. I mean, remember the color-coded system for terror alert levels in the United States, and how quickly that sort of became abused whenever you wanted to make people sweat or make people maybe stymie some disagreement. You unleash all of a sudden we're on orange. And I mean, not that I'm saying that's what's going on here, but you're right. There is something fundamentally there's some fundamental issues with what's being done with communication, and we're seeing it again. Yesterday, when Doug Ford comes out and says, you know what, maybe we're going to have some new restrictions for certain areas at the end of the week, and maybe and then on Tuesday you have Stephen Lecce coming out going, you know what, we're thinking about having a longer Christmas break, and then it comes out the next day, it's like, oh, we're not doing that. No, it's okay, don't worry, we're not doing that. And it's all just so reactive, and it's also responsive, and it's not what people want to hear. If you have like a coherent singular message, which is which is kind of what we had at the beginning of this back in the spring, where it was just like lock everything down, except for, you know, your local Walmart or grocery store or whatever.
The essentials,
you know, it was much more easier, but Frankly, it should be even more easier now that we kind of understand the fundamentals of how this virus spreads, and now that we understand how essential masking is to all of this, we should be having an easier time of it. Not necessarily like we're down to COVID zero, but because we know how it works, and because it is winter and everybody's going back inside, we were expecting a big uptick, but really nothing like this, where you have sections of Brampton that are showing higher transmission rates than the entire United States, where they just crossed 250,000 dead people from COVID-19. The onus is now kind of on the provincial government to sort out its proverbial crap in order to come up with a coherent message, which they haven't been able to do. And I think that's the first step that we really need to hang on to in order to start making progress on this.
Yeah, because these systems with shades, people don't really get nuance, right? It's either green, it's red, or it's lockdown. I mean, there really should be no in between. It's like, it's either everything's great, which it isn't, or even green, yellow. Like, just go with yellow, not yellow, and then orange, and then a wider shade of orange. Like, just, you know, it's lockdown or it's not. But I heard Ford say that more than once, his line staring down the barrel of the lockdown. And I thought it was a repeat, but in actual fact, he was wearing different clothes. I'm like, okay, this is the line now. Wait till Friday. And then, of course, they'll announce something on Friday and they'll be like, well, it won't actually be in effect till Monday, so everybody can get their act together. You know, it's like, okay. But you mentioned...
Well, not only that, but, you know, because of the concentration of the cases, like 1,300 of the 1,400 new cases that were announced yesterday were pretty much Toronto, Peel, and York. Mm-hmm. So you put people in lockdown there, fine, whatever.
Lock them down, yeah.
The thing is, though, it's not like there are any hard borders between Toronto and, you know, let's say Durham, or Peel and, let's say, Halton. You know, and we saw that a couple of weeks ago with the report that people were leaving the lockdown areas to go to gyms that have chains in other locations, and we saw it spread out from there. And it's just they're trying to do it halfway on all of it. They're trying to do it halfway on lockdown measures. Well, you can serve alcohol till 9 o'clock, but then it's last call. And they're trying to do it with you can have your fitness class as long as it's 10 people and everyone's wearing a mask, but not if it's 12 people. And it's you're right. It's just people don't understand nuance. It should be a three-step. One is the transmission rate is low, so, you know, go about your business cautiously. The third step is things are getting a little hairy out there. Take extra precautions. Don't go anywhere you don't have to. But, you know, be wary that there is more transmission in your community. And then the last step is, like, it's out of control. It's like Brampton Northeast, where it's like 19% or whatever it is. Just we have to close it down for 2 weeks to get a handle on this. But the other part of that is, and this is the part where the Ontario PCs are scared to death of going, which is having to pay for everyone to stay at home for 2 weeks. And that's the part of this they're desperately trying to avoid.
Yep, and that's it, because you know, in mentioning Brampton and why it's such a hot zone, and I think they're getting a bit of a raw deal, because one of the reports on the weekend was, there was a Diwali party, and that's part of the problem. Granted, something like that could be part of the problem, but, I mean, locally, I read this morning that there was $750 fines handed out this weekend for parties in our area, right? I don't think I'm assuming that they weren't Diwali parties, because it wasn't mentioned. Brampton is one of the engines of Ontario, but of the GTA in particular, right? So I'm trying to remember the exact quote. It's not an exact quote, but somebody said lockdown is pretty much people delivering everything to everyone else. And Brampton is a community that is full of what have been deemed essential workers. They were never essential until now. But when you've got a community of There are zones of lower income people, new immigrants. They staff the hospitals. They're cleaning up after people, PSWs, Uber drivers, the bus, truck drivers, who will get into it a bit, I guess, in terms of crossing the border and how many people do that, and larger families living in larger groups because of their economic situation. I mean, this is the reality. So,
well, also new immigrants.
Yeah. Exactly, right? So, but as you're saying, though, the part that is going to pain the government, but it's something that they will probably have to do, is to pay people to stay home. But not only that, to be able to give the people in what they are calling essential circumstances or situations, it's sometimes economic essentials. They can't not work, right? So regardless of whether they're providing for the people who are locked down, there needs to be more provision made for that. And let's even say just supplies given, you know what I mean? Like if that's a part of it, it's not just straight money. It's like, here, take this. Supposedly the government is sitting on a bunch of COVID funds from the feds that it hasn't doled out yet. Why not? Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. If it's as high as I think it is, I heard a number of 9 billion. I don't know if that was an exaggeration for somebody trying to score political points. And I actually tried to find out the origins of this number. But you would assume that there's cash there. You need to inject that into the community somehow, whether it's hard dollars or even just equipment or more buses or that kind of thing. Or it's not going to stop. It is not going to stop unless steps are taken. And you can't just get to the podium and start yelling, you guys, you can't party and you're not supposed to do this. It's like, that's getting really, really tiresome. We know parties are bad. Gathering in the home is not good with people who aren't related to you or live there, but come on, like, as Biden was like, come on, right? It's like,
right,
dude, we can only accept this rant so many times before it's getting pretty tiresome. We probably have another year of this, right?
Well, except the problem is that is kind of where the new cases are coming from. And our own medical officer of health, Dr. Mercer, posted this open letter to the community saying, like, hey, it's not at the restaurants and the bars or like the shopping malls where you're getting infected. It's going over to each other's houses, having birthday parties in storage units. I'm not sure who thought that was a brilliant.
Yeah, I saw that and I was, yeah. There's no way this is going to end if people are sticking 100 people in a storage unit of some kind, because it's the absolute worst indoor situation other than, say, this bunker right here to have a party because there's no air. I don't know if you've obviously been in a storage locker at some point. Sure. It's like, what are you people thinking? Are you trying to get under the radar with this?
Yeah, I don't know what the loophole was or what people were thinking, but yeah, it's
demented.
Just, the focus has been, and it's understandable given locking down everything in March and April and May, but that has always been the focus, and it is kind of the focus here. It's like, don't make us lock this place down. And what the message should be is like, what Dr. Mercer said in her letter, which is like, stay in your home. Stay with the people who are in your home. Don't let other people into your home. And if you do want to engage with other people, you know, face to face, as we like to do with our neighbors, you know, wear a mask, wash your hands, stay 6 feet apart. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like that simple of a message, because, I mean, because we've kind of been acclimatized, I guess is the word I'm looking for, to this idea of like, the bar is where you get infected, the restaurant is where you get infected, the school is where you get infected, anywhere where there's a large group of you. And then we forget that our home can also be a hotspot. And I think that's what the gist that Dr. Mercer was trying to get to. Your homes are now the hotspot because you invite people over. You think you're not at the bar. It should be fine. So here we go. We're at my house. We're going to take off our masks and, you know.
Share the cheese tray, right?
Yeah, have a coffee together.
Yeah.
And that should be the message. The hotspots are our homes now, and you have to stay out of the hotspots.
Yeah, a more intimate setting. And I mean, that's not to say that people should let their guard down in the community, but the counterpoint argument always is like, well, how come I can't have Ma over for coffee, but I can go to the gym or I can go to the mall? It's like, you're not getting it. It's like, you don't want, it's not Ma's going to give it to you. You don't want to give it to Ma. You have no idea. Like, asymptomatic transfer. You have no idea. This is the problem. I mean, as much as we've learned about COVID-19, there are still a lot of unknowns. And there's that, the majority of the list is like, well, we don't actually know where people are getting it. We know it's community transfer. We're pretty sure it's community transfer. When they say community, they don't mean just you out and about. It's like the community is everyone. So the people you have over to your house and whatnot. You mentioned schools there, and I find it interesting to sort of lead into the international or national angle to this, how, you know, this Ford has said, and Stephen Lecce said, oh, well, the schools aren't really the problem, but yet in other places in the world, and I just heard yesterday or today in the UK, it's like, yeah, it's actually a really high transfer there in the schools. And as we've learned, New York City are just shutting the schools early. They're like, no, you know what? Like, this is spiraling out of control. We should close the schools. Now, they did do it sort of suddenly and caught a lot of people off guard. And I'm not sure whether that announcement from the provincial government here was to kind of ease people into it, or were they trying to tease out, how do people feel about this? Or is it going to be, oh, man, I'm going to have the kids for a month and I can't work? So I think they floated it to see what the response was rather than just doing it. But it sounds, I'm not sure how it can be that in other places in the world, schools are massive transfer points. And as we've learned, there was that one case in Toronto where somebody has died, a worker, not a teacher, but somebody like a staff person, like auxiliary staff, has died from COVID-19. So it's like you can't. Then they said that case was community spread, but you sure? Like, this is a great question, right? Why not close the schools? Why not close the schools early? Right.
I don't know what the answer is, because we have seen transferral at schools. There was a teacher at a Toronto Catholic school who died of COVID-19 in the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. I think that the way that the government has phrased it is like, if, you know, schools will be the last thing to close. We are going to keep schools open at all costs. And they've kind of proceeded from that point of view, that schools are kind of like the last line of normalcy or something. Mm-hmm. But it is something I think we don't entirely understand. Yes, the kids don't necessarily get sick. A lot of the kids are asymptomatic, but I mean, the kids also go to school with teachers and other staff and helpers and ECEs, and then they go home to parents and perhaps, and I mean, it goes both ways too, because, you know, if you're having, your parents are having a gathering in a storage locker near your house and they're getting COVID, they're bringing it home to you, and then you take it to school and you pass it on to other kids who may be asymptomatic, and then who pass it on to the adults in their life. And it's just, I understand the underlying basis of this is that parents need to work, kids need to be in school all day in order to be able to work, because otherwise they have to find childcare, and then it's a whole other bailiwick. But it's putting the cart. It was a halfway measure. They did it half-assed, because the recommendation of the group from Sick Kids was like, okay, you want to send kids to school, you're going to have to create smaller class sizes. You're going to have to do these other things. You're going to have to upgrade the schools. And instead of doing, like, remember back in the summer, it was like the late July, early August, when that information started coming out, that what sizes classes would be, what upgrades were going to be made to schools. And also, it was like well into the summer before they got the budget documents, and for sure that school boards were able to firm up their budget documents. They keep saying that school is the most important thing, but they keep treating it like it's secondary or even tertiary.
Yeah, and that's until they get that sorted out, because it was all summer to have the plan, then it was kind of like, well, we're just going to sort of do this. There didn't seem to be very much confidence there. So looking across the country, and I'm thinking in particular in Nunavut, which was a place that kept things completely low for so long, and, you know, hearts go out to them, because they had, what, I think it was 60 cases in a week, gone way up from the one or two, or sometimes they didn't even register on the map because they were, people were isolating for 2 weeks on their way back there to go into a hotel. And so that has obviously fallen. Manitoba is, are they the worst right now in the nation per 100,000? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen cases rise in BC. So all of these places that we saw were sort of keeping it under control, keeping it back. For the longest time, it was just Ontario and Quebec that were the high numbers. But we are, you know, the numbers have definitely gone off the chart in our provinces as well. But turning again to our friends in the U.S., I did see something today talking about the essential workers who are exempt from quarantine regs coming back and forth across the border. We think that the border is closed a la the wall, but that's not the case at all. And it would seem the number that was being bandied around today was that there's been 5.3 million back and forth. Now, sometimes that's the same person who may be a truck driver, as you mentioned before, or say a nurse working in Buffalo going back and forth across the border. That is a hell of a lot of back and forth. So I think our border might be a little bit more porous than people like to think it is. And people are obviously not going down there or coming up here for leisure. I did see one thing that, you know, Florida is going to be Canadian free for the first time in years, probably relatively Canadian free, and that they will economically suffer down there. But of course, as we know, they've been one of the worst states as well, right? But Fauci's saying, you know, you should probably think about skipping Thanksgiving and Christmas too, but Fauci still seems to have his job. I don't know for how long. I guess we're going to get into that in part two, maybe. But, I would listen to Fauci before I'd listen to any of them. It's like, you probably shouldn't go home for Thanksgiving, which is in some ways a bigger American holiday than Christmas in places, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like, I have to get home for Thanksgiving. I don't know if that's their, you know, hallmark mode of living or something. I have to get home. This year you should probably take a pass.
Well, I mean, there are numerous issues with that. Number one is you have zero reaction from the current White House administration. It's clear that the president is not on it at all. The president is not even on anything, really.
His day planner is clear, if I understand it right. Right? It's just there's nothing there.
We'll get to that to a certain extent in part two of this. But yeah. The other part of it, too, and it's kind of summed up by this nurse who was interviewed on CNN on Monday, this nurse from South Dakota, which, by the way, South Dakota has like the third worst COVID mortality rate in the world, not in the United States, in the world.
I saw that active graph. Both the Dakotas, north and south, are just like off the charts.
The worst mortality rate in the world from COVID-19 goes North Dakota, the Czech Republic, and then South Dakota. Those are the top three worst places for COVID mortality in the world. But this nurse from South Dakota goes on CNN and says, yeah, I'm going into work every day. We're getting COVID patients out the butthole. And they keep coming in and going, I don't have COVID. Why are you telling me I have COVID? It's fake. It's a fake disease. And they swear up and down up until the minute they're either intubated or rolled out on the gurney to go down to the mortuary. They swear up and down it's fake. They don't have it. And like she said, she explained that there was somebody who yelled at her saying that they don't have COVID. Maybe they have lung cancer. I'm not sure in what world lung cancer is better than COVID-19. They're both pretty bad. But I mean, either way, you're sick and you need to be healed. Why not listen to the doctor? And I like, at least there's a chance you will get over COVID-19. It's that much harder to get over lung cancer and much more difficult to the system. And in some respects, when you talk about radiation or chemotherapy, but it's just bizarre. You can't really start to address a problem so long as everybody doesn't agree that there is a problem. And I think that's, you can't not tie the two, the mortality rate and the fact that there are hospitals full of people who refuse to believe that they're sick and dying.
I did see your retweet of that, and it's probably the most thoroughly depressing thing I've watched all week, but yet somehow she's able to, you know, keep, I got a hint of not there was nothing really positive about what she said, but you could tell she's like, okay, people are yelling at me, whatever. She's like, I can let that go because that's what I do. That is my job. So she's doing her job, and props to her for sure. But that's it. People are like diagnosing themselves, right? Or it can't be COVID. I think part of this too, we are once again bleeding into part two, but it's Trump's miraculous recovery, which wasn't that miraculous when you've got a chopper and money and all of the doctors thrown at you. And the way he presented from that has put, I think, in a lot of people's minds in the U.S. that, you know, well, Trump got over it, so I should too. It's like, are you not seeing this number of 250,000 dead? 56 million people worldwide with this thing, 1.3 million dead worldwide. And then you've got somebody bringing it back to the province like that Pastor Hillebrand down in Aylmer last weekend saying, there's no cases. Show me the cases. This is we're living in the land of the ridiculous. Right? Not just in case. It's insanity. What do you have to gain by presenting this narrative that COVID is not real? And go, you know, I know they have the church or whatever in Aylmer. Maybe that's their hometown, whatever. But people coming from all over. And my absolute favorite part of it was seeing protesters getting sprayed by a hose by the ultimate get off my lawn guy, because he was so pissed off at these people coming to his town going, no, it's not real. And get out. Don't even think about coming down my street. It's going to be bad. If you don't want to believe, that's fine, but stay the hell away from everybody else. Right. But it's permeated so many people's minds. It's like, oh, it's not real. It's, what do you mean? It's not real. You're dying of it. Right, yeah. You're lying there dying. If it's like, oh, it can't be that. What do you mean?
I mean, it's
unbelievable.
It speaks to like a rampant mistrust of expertise that, you know, we would have to take at least several hours to start to pull all the wires out and try to entangle them. But I mean, it's a couple of things. New number one was Donald Trump was on the campaign trail in the last week of the campaign saying, oh, by the way, on November 4th, the day after the election, you won't hear about COVID anymore. Because it's all a plot or a ploy to show me up. And then you have Scott Atlas, who's basically talking about ritual human sacrifice on television when he says, you know, no, you should have Thanksgiving. Have everybody over. Have grandma over. It might be the last Thanksgiving she ever has. And, I mean, part of you is logically like, yeah, if your grandmother's of a certain age, like every Thanksgiving might be her last. But if you invite her over in the midst of this with a bunch of people in your house, it's definitely going to be grandma's last Thanksgiving. You're absolutely right, Scott Atlas. The question is, would you rather have grandma around for potentially have grandma around for subsequent Thanksgiving, or virtually guarantee that this will be indeed her last Thanksgiving? And I really struggle with the fact that there are so many Americans for whom gambling with grandma's life is pretty okay right now.
Well, Scott Atlas is definitely one doctor who's, they should just take his license away, because they're just saying ridiculous stuff. You wonder sometimes where this comes from, and I mean, well, we know where it comes from. They're all sort of feeding off each other, but, you know, the feeding frenzy continues, and we'll get into that in part two. So, yeah, COVID, the story continues. We've got, I don't know. I'm wondering whether we'll be sitting here a year from now in our respective socially distance. We haven't actually seen each other pretty much all year, February maybe.
No.
Having this discussion. But we will advise people, because it is what you need to do, is masking and distancing. And please don't have a party. And for God's sakes, don't have your relatives over right now. Just don't do it. I think we can give that advice in good stead. And listen to the experts. Don't listen to Pastor Hillebrand. Anyway, but please listen to us every Thursday at 5 right here on CFRU 93.3 FM. We're going to take a bit of a breather, which I think we need. I'm flushed. I'm absolutely flushed in my freezing bunker. And we will get back to business in short order. So please stay tuned. Nothing like a good steam train song. That was The Kinks from the album Village Green Preservation Society. I think it was 1967. Last of the steam-powered trains. And, of course, Adam knows quite well why I played that. 6167 has gone to, hopefully, its final permanent home in town. Did you catch any of that, Adam? Or?
Oh, I watched some of it online. I mean, I have a lot of work to do, so I can't sit in them and watch a train drive be driven slowly down the road on a flatbed truck all day. So,
well, but surprisingly, the train moved really fast on the flatbed. That was the exciting part. We went down to have a look, and everybody was keeping their distance and masked. But the incremental part was actually getting it on the tracks. Gave up, went home. 4 hours later, they're still moving the thing. It was like, is it moving? We have a sizable TV. It was like, is it moving? I can't tell if it's moving. Who knows? But there's Guelph excitement, let me tell you, holy cow. And pandemic excitement, I suppose, to some degree. But hopefully that is where it will stay for a while. Let's hope. Speaking of trying to stay for a while, my goodness, Donald J. Trump will not pack it in, will he? It's just he won't. What was the latest? You were obviously following things this afternoon. I did see a bit of Giuliani's presser with it. I have to say, I felt a little bit nauseous when it was pointed out that Giuliani's hair was leaking. I mean, nothing sums up what is going on than Giuliani's ridiculously bonkers press conferences that have been going on. It was the landscaping one, and now the manscaping one, I guess. His hair was he looked like he was leaking oil. It was like a horror film. I was like, oh, and I wasn't sure if I might have to go for a COVID test, or this is making me nauseous. When does it end? This is the question. I sounded like Giuliani there, because he goes all, when is this gonna stop? Out of control.
I'm not sure where he gets off asking for $20,000 a day. Unless he's auditioning for an Adam Sandler movie or something.
Or a Borat movie.
the hair leaking, it's grim. Kind of pulled the plug on anything even remotely substantive in that press conference. I mean, and at the end of the day, it was just like,
because there wasn't any substance, was there? From when I watched a minute of it, I'm like, he's just going. Yeah.
No, he said something to the effect of like, I think the biggest pull quote out of it was that he said, like, look, if as soon as you eliminate the Wayne County vote, which is Detroit, which is 80% black, editor's note. But if you take away the Wayne County votes, Biden gets less votes. And it's like, yeah, tell us something we don't know. It's like, so his argument is basically getting up in front of the press and saying, look, the argument we have here is, if you get rid of everyone who voted for Joe Biden, Donald Trump wins this thing.
And Trump's,
right?
Yeah. And take away all the votes for the other guy, and this guy will win. Yeah, that makes total sense.
And I should note that margin, that voter margin. I mean, although it's like 100,000 here, 100,000 there, in like particular states, that swung this time. Joe Biden has won by millions and millions of votes.
Of fake votes. Pushed by the fake news and the radical left Democrats. That's pretty much all that Trump is saying, and he's only saying it on Twitter. As you said previously, he has no events. It's just, and every tweet has the little blue disclaimer. It's like, you know what? I'm surprised Twitter hasn't given up. But it's hot stuff. It's eyes on the prize stuff. Millions, millions of people watching, so they can't cut Trump off. I think they probably will, just ceremoniously on January 20th, just sort of put him in park unless he really goes off the rails. But he pretty much has. What were they calling him this week on Twitter? White House Karen. And Anita Recount was my personal favorite.
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy to call people names. I mean, this is really serious, though. Also serious is the march in solidarity in Washington, which included the Proud Boys. It was like, oh, man. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that's the last hurrah for that gang. So, okay, get it all out of your system, Trump types, especially those Trump types, because this is winding down. The last hurrah.
Yeah, the thing about that whole million MAGA march, which is literally what it was called, was that he drove right past it. You know, there was no thank you everyone for your support. There was no you know, happy to see all my people get out. I mean, even if he's going to keep prosecuting this, I was robbed in a rigged election, which he definitely shouldn't.
Yeah,
but. You know, even just showing some like gratitude for your supporters, even he's in, like, he just drove right on past to go golfing again. You know, I just constantly hit this this cognitive wall of like, what does it take for people to realize that they are backing someone who doesn't give a blanking blank about them?
Yes.
I had to censor myself because it's radio, you see.
Yeah, the beeper's broken. I'm glad you did. I'm just go boop. Yeah,
but that's the thing that kind of drives me crazy. And the second thing that drives me crazy about it is this saga with Emily Murphy, who is the general services administrator, whose all her job is to sign a piece of paper that says that releases funds to the transition team, the Biden transition team. That's all she has to do is sign a piece of bloody paper to get this whole thing going. And lo and behold, last night on CNN's website is this article that says, Emily Murphy is like super conflicted, everybody. She's like getting death threats from everybody because she just won't do anything. But she's like a super professional, guys. She's been like a lawyer a long time and she just needs time. And it's like, if she's feeling under pressure, she can sign that piece of paper and automatically half the pressure will go.
And then because, she needs to run to the hills. Yeah, yeah. But
because she's, and I mean, at the end of the day, too, she's got a job for 60 more days. She can decide to do it with some blanking dignity, or she can hold on to her chair and, you know, her pants for as long as she can to, you know, I don't know what she expects. I'd like, what does she think is going to happen at the end of all this?
She's going to be mere teeny tiny blip in the history of America and the universe, right? There are these moments where somebody you've never heard of appears, they're significant for like a little bit of time, and then they just go away. I think that's what will happen, right?
Right.
She's an admin, essentially, right? Like,
well, think about it this way, too. Name another GSA in American history.
Yeah, you can.
Isn't supposed to matter this much.
No. The pen is shaking. I said, I can't do it. You have to wonder what kind of pressure she is under, though, and who is putting that pressure on her. That's a burning question. But speaking of pressure, one thing Trump is doing is firing people, including, was it Chris Krebs was his name? The chief, I guess he was technically the chief of the election, for contradicting. He's not toying the fraud line. He's saying, no, the election was fine. I believe he's a Republican. He got smoked. There's a rumor list of other people that Trump wants to get rid of, including the directors of the CIA and the FBI. And he's already chopped the defense secretary, right? So who's next? Mm-hmm. And then there was the grumbling about the possible nuclear attack on Iran. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure.
I don't know if it was a nuclear attack, but it was like pondering military strikes on Iran because Iran is continuing with its nuclear program, and you know, which makes you automatically think, well, wouldn't it have been nice if there had been some sort of agreement that had forced Iran to stop trying to get nuclear weapons? Like, if only someone had done that, like, say, in the previous administration.
I'm just going to drop that to see how many retweets it gets. I mean, that's the kind of stuff. But speaking of Twitter, somebody on Twitter who's behaving very presidential is Mike Pence. I've never really looked at his Twitter. I looked at it and he's you know, saying congratulations to the astronauts and isn't it great that there's vaccines? He even dropped a happy Diwali, which was a surprise. Like, oh my goodness. If you didn't know anything and just looked and somebody gave you Pence's Twitter, you would think he was the president. Honestly. Like, it's a totally different world. You've got this guy behaving very presidential with everything that goes with Pence, and then the toddler in the corner going, yeah, I won. It was ridiculous. I was like, oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of very torn Republicans out there, such as Lindsey Graham, who is also feeling the heat a bit because he kind of implied that, they should look at those ballots and try and decide what could be chucked out. Where was that? South Carolina? I think it was South Carolina, right?
No, it's Georgia. He's the senator of South Carolina.
He's from South Carolina. That's right. Yeah.
Is not questioning his victory at all.
My victory is great, but Trump's is, is a prep. And the third in line to the throne, I didn't know they had this, such a lineage, Senator Grassley, age 87, the father of the house in the UK. That's the pecking order, right? He's third if something happens with Trump and then Pence, right?
Nancy Pelosi's the third in line.
So he must be, is he fourth? I don't know. Anyway, he will be, he has coronavirus, aged 87, not good. So he's isolating. There's obviously cases galore in Washington, certain circles. So I don't know. Maybe they're going to be first with the vaccines, experimental or otherwise. Just give it to me. Just spray it in my face. Save me now. So, yeah, who knows?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is with Lindsey Graham is, first of all, he made the call. He called, basically trying to get the Georgia Secretary of State, who is a Republican, by the way, to throw out, people who and they've kind of phrased it like this is like, we need to count all the legal ballots. Which then implies that there are illegal ballots, which, then Lindsey Graham goes like, you need to throw out the illegal ballots. And Georgia Secretary of State is like, dude, there are no illegal ballots. And Lindsey Graham says, well, what about all the people who voted for Biden? And then second of all, Lindsey Graham gets cornered in the halls of the Senate. He's like, look, I also called the Secretary of State of Arizona and Nevada and like asked them the same question. So I'm like totally looking up for the legitimacy of the election, guys. And then both the Secretary of State of Arizona and the Secretary of State of Nevada came out and said, we haven't talked to Lindsey Graham about Jack. And, so it just looks so bad all over the place. And then the coup de grace was they had Senate meetings this week. They had Senate votes. And, of course, one of those people who is still technically in the Senate is Vice President-elect Harris. And she is there in the wall of the Senate talking to others. And in comes Lindsey Graham and fist bumps her. And I'm like, God, you are such an effing suck up. It's like, not only are you licking Trump's boots at every opportunity, you see the incoming vice president and you're like, ooh, let me fist bump you because we're Senate colleagues and I can't wait till you're vice president. And then he, goes back to licking Trump's boots. It's like, just like, find one ass to kiss, Lindsey, and stick with it.
Ain't that politics, right? And I guess the Democrats are in the majority right now because of these people that are isolating with COVID. So mm-hmm. if they wanted to, they could steamroll some things through. Yeah, because I think that's what happened. Harris had to show up for a vote, right? So even though she's VP, presumptive VP, still has to go to work and make sure the business gets done until they close down for Christmas. I don't know how that's going to go, but I'm sure it will be interesting. I sometimes when I'm hearing these stories, I feel like, when Homer Simpson zones out and I just see the Looney Tunes kick line in my head that on with the show, this is it. It's like, that's what I picture. Like, I think I need a vacation, but there's nowhere to go. So finally today, talking a bit of another Can U.S. story is pipelines that have come back with a vengeance into the news, in particular Line 5, which would affect us directly or indirectly. I guess if you consume petroleum in Ontario, then this would affect you. Governor Whitmer of Michigan has called time on the pipeline, first carved in 1953. It's an Enbridge pipeline. And pipelines, are, as they are in Canada, are a federal responsibility, but there's something called the public trust doctrine that the state can play this card and say, look, they're not living up to this deal. I think in Enbridge's case, in particular, the pipeline has been sustaining anchor damage. The way it's supported under the lake is wrong. It doesn't have the right coating on it. Now, Enbridge is kind of pulling out the stops in terms of defending their pipeline, but it sounds like this may, Line 5 may actually tank.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this has also been a thing since 1953, and it's part of like sort of a broader trend that I think is only going to get worse once Joe Biden officially takes office, which is the dwindling number of people who want pipelines passing through their area. Granted, we have a newly minted NDP majority in BC that is going to go full speed ahead with TMX. But, I mean, Keystone XL, I mean, that's as good as gone. And there's been this interesting discussion about how much Biden owes to people who are, like, really far left progressive in terms of his coalition.
Mm-hmm. You owe us.
I mean, yeah, Biden's election owes a lot to sort of like more middle ground, middle income, center left or right people who might have voted another way if mm-hmm. the Republican nominee had been someone reasonable, let's say. But the sort of the loudest people who sort of drove that momentum were people on the left. And there's going to be a serious question about how much Biden owes them and how much he can do to please them, because without the Senate, he's not going to be able to do much. But one of the things he can do very, very easily is say no more Keystone XL. And I mean, whatever's going on with Gretchen Whitmer and Ontario right now, that is like that. I mean, that seriously affects us in our area. But in terms of the more broad question is, you know, U.S. Canada relations will get better in many regards, but on pipelines, it's not going to get better for Jason Kenney from this point on.
No, he's been in the news far too much this week for my taste. But anyway, so people may remember that Obama vetoed the Keystone XL in 2015, you know, for various reasons, but the fact that it's not hitting the bar in terms of, I'd hate to sort of parse it and shorten it to pleasing those people, but there are a lot of players and a lot of factors in it. And then Trump rebooted it, I guess. When was that? In 2017. Mm-hmm. So Joe Biden is probably going to try and undo, as Trump did with Obama. Joe Biden, president-elect, will try and undo a lot of what Trump has done over the past few years. I think he's quoted as saying that we don't need tar sands oil and it's a very high pollutant, which was Obama's opinion as well. But what are they called now? TC. They've changed it up from TransCanada to TC. It's like KFC. They're the KFC of oil. They've been pulling out the stops in terms of saying, well, you know, Joe Biden should like this because it's union jobs. There's indigenous support. I mean, there's indigenous support in places, but, you know, whatever. And it fits right into the Build Back Better agenda, which is a phrase I really hate. Not only is it grammatically like, what? It's like Build Back Better. It's like, it sounds like you're going to buy a new GMC and or any truck and just sort of travel across, stomping across the states. Yeah, so and jobs. It's like, well, there'll be jobs. There'll be 7,000 jobs. So 7,000 jobs are building the line, and then, because to me it's always like the and then what.
Yeah.
And then what? Is no one going to monitor the line? I think this is part of the issue with the with Line 5 going under the Great Lakes. I would hope that pipeline has had some new parts since 1953. But it sounds like they are putting in a line in a tunnel. I was reading this in the, I think it was in the fake news New York Times, that they're building a tunnel for a new oil pipeline under the water. Mm-hmm. And supposedly that won't be affected by this decision at all. So it's almost as if they're not having it both ways, but they're hedging the bets that, like, okay, if we dig this tunnel and put a pipeline in it, and they say no to Line 5, we'll still be able to shift X amount of barrels, millions probably, of liters anyway, per day. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure where that's going to go. It was kind of a footnote at the end of this article after all the discussions, and they talked about Jason Kenney, and they also talked about Greg Rickford. They called him the oil minister. Like, he's like natural. I can't, he's a long title, right? Natural resources or whatever. Yeah. But Canada's oil minister. I was like, yeah, I guess he probably is a Canadian oil minister for sure. But right. Yeah, Kenny's will not relent. He's just like, oh, oil and gas. We gotta get the oil and gas. It is a war for our economic future, I think was her, his exact words. Yeah. So
he said that on a post-media podcast, and he said, you know, anyone who would want to cut oil and gas exports are quote, would have to be brain dead, unquote. And it's like, I hate to tell you, Jason, you're like, you're kind of the one who seems kind of brain dead on this, because number one, you can't sell it anywhere. Number two, nobody seems to want to buy it in the immediate future. Number three, it's cheaper to get oil and gas if people do want to buy oil and gas for other, from other places. Four, you're now in year six of a downturn that you kind of promised what you would turn around, and it was all the NDP's fault in the first place, even though the downturn started before the NDP took office. Five, you keep handing out tax cuts, which the oil company keeps taking to merge with other companies and then cut more jobs. And six, I can't remember where six was, but
well, that's a pretty good list. You've nailed it. Yeah,
there's just so much going on with this that, you know, when you come right back to it, is they keep his insistence that oil and gas is the future, and at the same time, the more he promises that, and the less likely it is to happen. The end result is, too, he's likely going to create another schism that will fracture his party again, because you're always going to have the hardliners versus the people who are going to embrace a certain reality. And that schism is kind of already basically there with the Wexit movement, although we haven't heard much from the Wexit movement lately. But I mean, it's still there.
So now the anti-mask movement, yeah. Probably, I mean, right? Well,
probably more than a few. But I mean, at the same time, you know, you have Trudeau saying, like, I'm talking to President-elect Biden about pipelines. You have François-Philippe Champagne talking about keeping the dialogue open about this. So, like, the Liberals are still full speed ahead on pipelines. Mm-hmm. Maybe not full speed ahead, but, like, maybe medium speed ahead. Like, they realize
Liberal speed ahead.
Right, there's liberal speed ahead. That's a good term that should be incorporated. But that's still a reality of the situation, is that there are sort of more pragmatic politicians that realize selling oil is going to be a thing for the at least the medium term. But Kenny and the UCP are basically promising, like, no, it's not only is it going to come back, it is going to come back to like $100 a barrel or more. And it's like 6 years later, I'm not sure at this point how you can still promise that. Because there's no sign it's going to bounce back to the levels that you want it, and then what happens?
Yeah, that's this magic.
Politically and economically.
Yeah, it's this magic thinking that oil is going to save everything. But when it comes down to the let's call it the capitalist root of it, it's like, if people don't want your product, then they don't want it, right? Yeah. So what you're going to force tar sands oil on people. Or oil sands oil. Oil sands oil? That's redundant. But yeah, you can't. You just can't. And if you accept that model, then you have to accept the fact that the model has to change. And there's this reluctance to do it. I'm not sure of Kenny's roots. We know Harper's roots and the roots of a lot of people in that party are within the oil and gas industry. That's a given. Mm-hmm. But is it the end of the line for it, right? Trending is the... Everybody is getting out of this business eventually. You know, the magic number that keeps coming up is 2050. By then, it'll be too late. But even the companies are they're divesting from their own product. They're looking for other avenues to be profitable companies.
Well, most governments are moving to like a net zero by 2050, including our own local government. Mm. And then on top of this, too, is there was an environmental defense report that said basically whatever pipeline capacity we have that is currently being built or that currently exists, that is going to suit the production that is likely to happen through to 2030 and through to 2040. So in a sense, I mean, there are questions out there about whether or not building more pipelines is just magic beans that some oil companies are trying to sell, because if true, then we currently have all the pipelines we need to meet production, and building more pipelines, there's no evidence that building more pipelines is going to magically create more production.
Precisely. Yeah. Well, we are at net zero for time. So I was trying to think of something pithy to say, but I got nothing.
That was good.
I'll save it for next week. Adam, if people want to find out more about you and what you do in this town and across the world on the internet, how can they find you?
I am on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, and you can find me at GuelphPolitico.ca as well.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and you can find us here every Thursday, like literally every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can find us on the internet at CFRU.ca. I'm certain that some of you are listening via that method. And it would seem we are on Friday morning and Monday morning. At least we were last week. So we are repeated on Friday morning at 7 a.m. if that time suits you better. So, Adam, our dreams have come true. We are actually a drive time show. Although no one's driving anywhere because we're locked down. We're in code taupe. I don't know what code we're in, but we'll talk about that a bit more next week. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone. And take care.